Welcome, everybody, to this throwback edition of the World Soccer Talk Podcast. I'm your returning temporary host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. You know, just when you thought you were rid of me, I am back filling in for Nipun Chopra for the next month as he is in India. Call it a familiar voice coming back into your life. Of course, one familiar voice that hasn't left you recently, my co-host Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, how have you been?
I've been good, Richard. Great to be back with you. I've actually been more recently on a pod with you than on World Soccer Talk, just because we've had some technical difficulties with our pod. So we recorded the show for y'all on Sunday, and we weren't able to get it out. So we apologize for those technical difficulties.
Yeah, speaking of technical difficulties, I'm on the road right now. Normally, I'm in Portland, Oregon. I've been spending the last week in Southern California. I'm in Northern California right now, just outside the San Jose Earthquake Stadium, ahead of tonight's San Jose-New York Red Bulls game. And as a result, Skype has decided not to let Kartik and I be co-hosts for the show. We're coming to you over traditional telephone lines tonight, at least one of us. But the important thing is we're going to talk about the midweek action in Europe today. Some earth-shaking results in Champions League, to the extent that the earth ever shakes over soccer results. We're also going to talk about Thursday's match in Europa League, at least the big one between Borussia Dortmund and Liverpool, and then this weekend's action in the Premier League, where the fights for fourth and the relegation battle are going to be in focus. But Kartik, let's start with Wednesday's results in Champions League, and doesn't have much bearing on the Premier League, but a lot of focus was on the match at the Vicente Calderon today, where Atletico Madrid went into their game against Barcelona down 2-1, having given up two goals with 10 men at the Camp Nou last week. Two goals from Antoine Griezmann puts Atleti through into the semifinals for the second time in 3 years, eliminating Barcelona at the quarterfinal round. A lot of people surprised by this one, Kartik. To what extent were you surprised with today's result?
That's a very good question, because at the beginning of the tie, I when the draw was made that day, people who followed me on Twitter probably saw that I thought Atleti could beat them, and could beat them over two legs, 1-0 basically, and maybe get an away goal at the Camp Nou in the first leg, be up 1-0 and sit on that game, and then sit on the game back at the Calderon. Now, it was going according to plan for me until Torres committed that stupid second yellow card offense and got himself sent off with 61 minutes and stoppage time left remaining in the first match at the Camp Nou. And, of course, true to Barca form, they kept a lot of the ball. They weren't able to finish chances until they finally broke through and they got the two goals. So then I thought after the first leg, you know what, it's over. I had a game plan in my mind. I think it was the same game plan Simeone had in his mind that would have carried Atleti, and Torres just really blew it for all of us. So I didn't put much on today. So I guess I get half credit for this, because before the tie, I thought Atleti very well could win. I went on record saying they could win. But the path to victory that I envisioned was blown out of the water by that red card, or that second yellow that sending off for Torres. But today they really they came good. Griezmann with the goal, a fantastic finish. Some great defending, clutch defending. Godin, we've seen do this time and again. I thought Oblak was very good in goal. He's typically very good. He's one of the more underrated keepers in world football. And you have to just marvel at Atleti's organization, their shape, their structure, and their spirit.
For a lot of this match, even though Atletico spent most of the day hovering around 20% possession, they got it up to around 28 by the end of the match, but Barcelona went most of this match without a shot on target. It was, in that way, a stereotypical Atletico performance, clearly the best defense in Europe. Even though Barcelona has some shouts for a penalty at the end of this one, I don't think anybody is going to argue that Atletico didn't deserve their semifinal spot. Kartik, I think the natural thing here is to reflect on what Atletico has accomplished. And we find ourselves doing this seemingly every 3 or 4 months over the last 3 years or so. Seemingly, Atletico keeps going to new heights. Of course, they were in the Champions League final 2 years ago when they also won La Liga. But for some reason, this seems a little bit more special, because this Barcelona team has been so great and so dominant, even though they've hit a wall this month. And there was the perception a couple years ago that Atletico was a bit of a Cinderella Cinderella story. It was kind of a magical season. It wasn't going to happen again. Well, Atletico has sustained. They have finished in the top three last year again in Spain, and this year they are now mounting another title challenge. And it's very difficult to put into words what Diego Simeone has been able to do for that team. They have some resources, but they still can't spend as much as Real Madrid and Barcelona. Yet at this point, we have to confess that they are every bit as good as their two Spanish rivals.
Absolutely, and they do it in a different way. They're defensively organized. They're very sound structurally. There's this great team spirit in the squad, and they can lose players and continue to replace them. Just think about the number of strikers they've lost through the years. And then to see Arda Turan come on for Rakitic, which, by the way, may not have been the smartest substitution for Luis Enrique, but to see Turan come on and lose to Atleti, you know, I thought when they lost him to Barca, that was a sure sign, okay, it's over. Teams being dismantled, Barca, Real Madrid, Bayern, those clubs, Chelsea, they'll just pick the pieces they want, and it's over. And Turan has come back to face Atleti at the Calderon and lost in a Barca shirt. Just think about the symmetry of that.
It does say a lot about how the two teams go about building their squads. It's just incredible. Atletico into the Final Four again and really established themselves as a consistent power in Europe, something none of us could have foreseen 3 weeks ago. Let's flip the coin over here, Kartik, and let's talk about Barcelona. Do you think anything less of Barcelona as a result of this outcome?
No, nobody in the Champions League era has repeated this. Champions of Europe, and the closest we got to it was maybe Manchester United in 2009, and then Barca blew them out of the water, and then we see how difficult it is to repeat. That Barca team that people now are thinking is the best of the modern era get beat by Inter the next season over two legs, and Bayern we've seen only win one Champions League in this era of great Bayern domination, where they got into the semifinals of the Champions League now with this win today that we'll talk about shortly, six out of the last seven seasons, they've been in the semifinals of the Champions League, but they've only won one Champions League in that period. So it's very difficult. I mean, there was a period of time where Real Madrid couldn't get past the round of 16. Keep that in mind, for years and years and years. So I think we may put too much emphasis on how dominant Bayern, Barca, and Real Madrid have appeared to have become versus the rest of the field in Europe. And remind ourselves that they have to face one another, and then they have to face sides like Atleti and Borussia Dortmund and others that pop up for a couple of years here and there that are tough to get out of the way.
Yeah.
And are tough to defeat on a regular basis. Look, Atleti were very unfortunate they didn't get by Real Madrid last season. They eliminated Barca two seasons ago, and then they were unfortunate in the final that year against Real Madrid as well. They've proven they can hang with anyone in Europe.
And it is a lesson along the same lines that you were talking about, against thinking that things are too predictable in European soccer, that the powers that have all this money, that spend all this money, are somehow impenetrable or invincible. As if the Premier League season this year hasn't taught us that on England's front, we have Dortmund bouncing back from a bad year in Germany to sustain this title challenge far deeper in the year than anybody thought they could. We have Atletico Madrid now within arm's length of Barcelona in Spain. I think that we get too used to thinking that dominance is sustainable for longer than it is. Even Barcelona this year, as they had an undefeated streak that approached 40 games before Real Madrid beat them at the Camp Nou. It's just so easy, and in that way so lazy, to think that what's happened recently can continue.
The only place where lazy analysis works is when you're talking about Arsenal, because they finish in the same place in the league every year, and they finish at the same, get eliminated in the same round of Champions League every year. But other than that, we have to push against these stereotypes.
Wow, if you had the under on Kartik and I getting to Arsenal, you're drinking right now, because we didn't even make it to the 10-minute mark before hitting on one of our favorite topics. Kartik, you already mentioned this result. I don't think there's much to say about Bayern and Benfica. Benfica certainly put up a better fight than most people suspected. Like every other matchup in the quarterfinal round, it ended 3-2. Bayern with a 2-2 draw today, and Portugal goes through to yet another semifinal. And Kartik, while on one level the 3-2 result probably is closer than most of us thought this would be given the talent of these two teams, it's easy to look beyond that and just think about how remarkable it is that Bayern, at the same time that Barcelona has failed to make the semifinals two of the last 3 years, is back in the final four of this tournament again.
Right. So it's five successive years and a six out of the last seven in the semifinals, which is just unbelievable. That's a remarkable record. And for Real Madrid now, I believe it's is it six straight seasons in the final,
three Mourinho, two Ancelotti, and now this year.
Right. And before that, there were seven consecutive seasons they lost in the round of 16. So there is some hope for Arsenal fans, the difference being Real Madrid won some league titles in that period. But that's similar to Arsenal's streak of round of 16 exits right now. Those of you who are newer fans may not realize Real Madrid, after their initial Galactico era began, had that real run of misfortune. Yeah. For a long time. You're getting eliminated by the likes of Lyon on multiple occasions. They got eliminated by Bayern a year that Bayern was so bad in Germany they didn't even qualify for the Champions League the next year. So they've had some bad luck. They've had some bad times before that. Bayern has been remarkably consistent and able to play through a lot of injuries. Pep has had to do a lot of reshuffling with this team. So this is probably the best job he's done at Bayern this season, because he's had to reshuffle their back line so much, and they've been run real close by Borussia Dortmund. I think Dortmund would probably win just about any other league in Europe, and that might include La Liga. I don't think it does, but it might. They would certainly win the Premier League or Liga or the Serie A. So this is a kind of an underrated job Pep has done this season, given all the injuries.
Yeah, expectations are so high there. I don't think anybody is going to appreciate him consistently getting to the semifinals, but in light of what other teams have done, other teams with similar talent, it really is a remarkable feat. We'll see who they end up drawing in the semifinals, because it could be his future team, Manchester City. Let's put that off and save that for the finale. Let's talk about the other tie that was resolved on Tuesday. Wolfsburg went to the Santiago Bernabeu on the backs of a 2-0 upset last week over Real Madrid. Cristiano Ronaldo with a hat trick puts Real Madrid into the final four. The thing about this result that I find weird, Kartik, is Real Madrid players and some of the media acting as if there was some kind of great comeback. Did you ever really doubt that Real Madrid was going to overcome that 2-goal deficit? I mean, I guess I doubted a little bit, but I always thought Real Madrid was still going to go through.
Yeah, no, I thought it was going to be a lot like Bayern's comeback against with the Porto last year, when they were down 2-1 after the first leg, and then just absolutely they had the tie won within 15 minutes of the home leg, the second leg. In fact, it didn't turn out that way. Yes, Real Madrid got two quick goals from Ronaldo, quick hat trick, but Wolfsburg actually had several chances after those first two goals from about minutes 20 to minutes 45. Minute 45. I would say they had four good chances, and they should have buried one of them.
Yeah.
So that, to me, was really surprising, because I thought I came into this thinking Real Madrid was just going to run away with it and that they would win 5-1 or something, and we would just look back and say, okay, well, it was a one-off that first match. In fact, in spite of winning the second leg 3-0, they were incredibly open, and Wolfsburg just didn't take their chances. They should have advanced.
Yeah, Paulo Henrique in particular, with what the kids like to call a gilt edge chance, probably be thinking about that one for a while, because had he converted that, Wolfsburg goes through on away goals. We've put it off long enough, Kartik. Let's talk about the result that's close to your heart. Manchester City with a 1-0 win over Paris Saint-Germain. They make it to the final four of Champions League for the first time in club history. Tell us your reactions, Kartik.
Well, it was amazing as a fan to experience that, and the kind of night it was at the Etihad, and the spirit and the excitement within the crowd. I mean, a lot of times Manchester City has a static atmosphere since moving from Main Road, and we see it at various times in the league, and we see it actually more often than not on European nights, because either midweek games, this competition has not really been warmed up to by City supporters. You even see it with the booing of the UEFA anthem before the game. That's actually a tradition now. I know the commentators picked up on it this time, but that's something that's been frequently happening for some time now. And yet there was this fantastic energy and atmosphere on the ground that spread to the side. And Aguero and Silva in particular, who have been kind of hit or miss lately, were really playing with their hearts on their sleeves early in the match. Aguero misses a penalty, unfortunately, but De Bruyne coming back into the team, there's not much more you can say about that. I mean, that's really kind of transformed City and made you think, what if he hadn't he hadn't gotten injured. Could they have pushed for the league title? Possibly, although I don't see a whole lot of cracks in Leicester's armor. I know we'll get to that later in the show. The other thing I think needs to be pointed out from this tie, I don't know if people saying it, Mangala and Otamendi were tremendous. You're finally kind of justifying the investment made on those two center backs. The flip side of the equation is once again, Zlatan has failed in Champions League, and once again, PSG has failed, and Laurent Blanc. So that's 14 trips to the Champions League for Zlatan without winning a Champions League. We know Inter won it after he left. Barca won it right before he got there. Milan won it before he was there. It's a tough one for the player. It really is, because it's not on him, but unfortunately, for him, I don't think he's going to win this greatest prize in European football or European club football in his career.
Yeah, and it stands in such stark contrast to the almost unprecedented success he's had at the league level. It is an amazing curiosity.
And by the way, in those 14 seasons, I think, well, okay, so the first season, we don't put it in. I think in the last 13 seasons, he's won the league 12 times. Amazing.
Yeah, and the only time is when he finished second with a Milan team that has since collapsed to mediocrity in Serie A.
Right, and had won the title the previous year. The year he got there, they won the title very unexpectedly. Then the following season, they ran Juve close. He leaves to PSG, as to Thiago Silva significantly, not just Ibra. Those two players go to PSG, and Milan has been a mid-table team basically since.
Let's talk about PSG for a little bit, and then let's dovetail back to Manchester City, because as you mentioned, there are a lot of aspects of the team that played on Tuesday that deserve credit. But there was a lot of controversy surrounding PSG and one of our favorite managers, Laurent Blanc, because somewhat inexplicably, he decides to go to a three center back system out of the blue against a team that typically plays with a lone striker up front. Manchester City has been almost exclusively a 4-2-3-1 team this year because they haven't had a second striker consistently performing or consistently healthy to pair with Kun Aguero up top. Yet, Laurent Blanc still goes with three center backs. I think I agree with most of the Twitter universe in being just completely confused by this move.
I didn't get it at all. I mean, I was stunned by it. If this was Blanc trying to show his tactical acumen, well, what a time to do that. I don't have an explanation for it other than being shocked. And being in such disbelief about it, I didn't tweet it until about 7 minutes into the match because I didn't believe what I was reading on Twitter and didn't believe what I was seeing on the pitch to be actually their formation, but thought they were just asymmetrical or there was some sort of somebody had been pulled out of position, and that's why we saw three guys playing at center back. I was really shocked. And then once Thiago Mota, who's really the two-way player who shields that back three, or back four normally, right? Once he gets injured, they were done for. I mean, it was at that point, I didn't want to say it and be cocky. As fatalistic as all our listeners know I am about City, I kind of knew the tie was won at that point. When he went off after they had made this real faux pas defensively in how they set up.
Yeah. In a must-win game, in the best chance that Paris Saint-Germain has had to make the Champions League Final Four since Laurent Blanc live, or since the Paris Saint-Germain revolution began, Laurent Blanc put out a team that only had six shots. Now, granted, four of those were on target, but in a must-win game, when your opponent already has two away goals, you put out a team that only generates six shots when the other team's best defender isn't playing, when the other team's best midfielder isn't healthy enough to start. It's inexplicable to me how a team with that much talent could be put in a position to fail so noticeably in their biggest game in potentially club history, or at least recent club history. Let's double back to Manchester City, Kartik. I kind of want you to make me a promise, because I don't think I'm going to be on the show much next year, but there is going to be a time when all of the summer transfers are coming in that people will look at a big money buy and say, oh, why is that club buying that player? Because they already have four or five players like that at that position. You know, the Kevin De Bruyne argument that we heard in September of this year. Well, Kevin De Bruyne is showing that Manchester City, even though they had a wealth of talent in attacking midfield, he's showing that he is a special player that transcends whatever depth the team might have in their squad before the acquisition. He really, really came up big on Tuesday.
Yeah, and he came up big in the first leg, too. He's just he's a next-level player, and this is another reason why I know Hazard has tailed off, but I hate to keep bringing it up, but and now we've had terrorism and all kinds of other distractions in Belgium, but I still think Belgium is probably going to win the Euros this summer because they have more of those types of players. And in De Bruyne, it's one we weren't even thinking about 2 years ago or when we were talking about them around the World Cup. We thought he was a core 11 player for Belgium, but he's now an elite player in world football. He's shown it just by Manchester City with and without him. Wolfsburg with and without him, you know, with him, they're running second in the Bundesliga. Without him, they're not going to make it back to Europe. But it's an amazing contrast with him. Manchester City are close to top of the table. They're sitting 2 points behind Leicester. Without him, look at it. They're very fortunate they're not behind, West Ham at this point. West Ham has had some dodgy calls in games, since our pod was lost on Sunday. I'll say that they should have beaten Arsenal. And, again, another dodgy call did them in, but, he's a next level player. And that's why Manchester City broke, the club's transfer record to go out and get him. I hate to bring this up, Richard. You know, I'm going to. What was Jose Mourinho thinking?
Well, there's a whole list of players at this point, right? Because now we're hearing that Chelsea might go in for Romelu Lukaku this summer. And it's just, what's going on at Chelsea where that there seems to be no coherent strategy?
Speaking of needs right now for them, now they're going to get him back in a year, but they loaned out Christensen for 2 years, and that's a player that would be starting for them right now if they hadn't loaned him out. And that was just this summer.
No, that's a very good point. I'm sure we can make a pretty decent starting 11, a starting 11 that's better than the starting 11 that Chelsea has put out there most of this year from the players that either Chelsea has out on loan or have discarded in favor of the players that are currently in the squad. They need to get their act together because it doesn't matter how many resources you have. If you can't use those resources effectively, you're going to end up in the situation Chelsea is in now. So Kartik, we have two teams from Spain, the Madrid sides, Atletico and Real Madrid in the final four, joined by Manchester City and Bayern Munich. What matchups do you want to see in the semifinal?
Probably City Bayern and then the Madrid derby in the semis. I think Atleti's going to win the Champions League. I'm going to go on record and say that right now. And yes, it took them penalties and a fortunate penalty at that to get by PSV in the round of 16. But sometimes these things are written in the stars. We saw that with Chelsea. They never should have gotten past Napoli in the round of 16 that year. Same thing with Atleti this year with PSV. And I just got the sense watching the resolve and the purpose in the second half today that they didn't think they'd be back in this position that they were in 2 years ago. And now that they are, they're going to win it. That's just my sense. So I'd like to see a Madrid derby and then the Pep derby, if you will. And there's been an awful lot of games already between Manchester City and Bayern. They played six times in Champions League games over the course of the last five seasons. So I might as well make it eight.
Well, you get these 180-minute ties. They take on a completely different dynamic, as we saw with Barcelona and Atletico Madrid. Kartik, let's briefly talk about the competition that takes place on Thursdays. Europa League, Shakhtar Donetsk went into Portugal last week, got a 2-1 victory over Braga. They go back to Ukraine and control their tie. Villarreal, 2-1 win at home over Sparta Praha. Sevilla got a 2-1 win at Athletic Club. I'm not sure home field means that much there. Those are both La Liga clubs. But the one matchup we want to talk about, Borussia Dortmund and Liverpool. Liverpool really putting up a good fight last weekend against the Borussia Dortmund team that tried to turn it on in the second half. They still got out of Germany with a 1-1 result. What are your thoughts on this one, Kartik? It certainly seems like Jurgen Klopp leveraging some of the knowledge he has of his old team to bridge the talent gap between the two sides.
Right, and Origi is beginning to score goals, which we thought when that started to happen, that would be really a bonus for Klopp because he's preferred Origi in that starting 11 to Sturridge and Benteke anyway because of his work rate and the amount of running he does, the amount of chasing he does, closing down on the ball in a high-pressing system. Now all you need is for that striker to start scoring goals. Well, he scored a goal against Dortmund, and then he scored two goals at the weekend against Stoke. And that's a bonus. When you have a striker scoring goals and you're creating havoc with kind of that high press, that is really, really something that Klopp can count on now. They're not going to have Jordan Henderson. He's out.
Unfortunately.
Joe Allen looked pretty, that's a big loss for this particular matchup. Joe Allen looked like he was adequate in the league at the weekend, and Lucas is back, which is, I think, very, very important for them and very good as far as if they want to sit on the game at any point. Dortmund didn't play particularly well in the first leg. And then this weekend against Schalke, they rotated a little bit. The young American Christian Pulisic got a start. I think it's only his second start in the Bundesliga this season. 17-year-old American, our great hope for those of us on this side of the Atlantic. And he played very well for about 75 minutes, but they gave away a dodgy penalty at the end, a little bit of a dodgy penalty, and Huntelaar scored. So they've now fallen 7 points behind Bayern in the league, so they're going to be all in on this competition. And Tuchel, by rotating and keeping Aubameyang on the bench and keeping Royce on the bench and keeping a couple of other Gundogan didn't start, keeping a couple of their other really star players on the bench indicated to me that he didn't expect the result that Klopp got against him. And obviously, not only has Tuchel taken over from Klopp at Dortmund, for those of you who don't follow the Bundesliga, he took over for him from at Mainz also, and their coaching philosophies are very similar, although there's one little thing I think that's different about Tuchel is that his wide players tend to run, make more diagonal runs in space than the Dortmund wide players did under Klopp. That's one little tactical nuance that's different. Not to say that they didn't make diagonal runs under Klopp, but under Tuchel, they're running diagonally and like perfectly diagonally, not these kind of wavy runs, countless times during the game. But I think Tuchel didn't expect Klopp to come to the Wolfstadion and get that result, and then that just threw him off for the derby. Schalke is their biggest rival, for those of you who don't know. In Schalke, Dortmund is one of the biggest derbies in all of Europe. He ended up, rotating and starting a 17-year-old American kid in that game, and several other, Adrian Ramos and these other guys who don't normally start for them, because then he realized, my gosh, I've got to have a fresh team, a fresh first team for my, trip back to Anfield on a European night. So, it threw Dortmund off that result, and it probably just cost them any shot they had of catching Bayern in the league. So, They're all in on this, and this is going to be a classic game. I can't pick a winner. I think it's going to be very close.
Yeah, I'm not going to dare to pick a winner. I'm just very impressed that Klopp has gotten his team in this position to where I think somebody can reasonably think that, based on the fact that they're at home and Bayern has to that Dortmund has to travel midweek, that Liverpool's the favorite to go through at this point. You mentioned the difference between Klopp and Tuchel. Henrik Mkhitaryan gave an interview recently regarding that. And part of the reason that this interview was noteworthy is that he said some things that were very, I guess you can phrase it, favorable to Tuchel or against how Klopp had him play. And I think it's the style of player that Mkhitaryan is, that he wasn't super keen on the constant pressing and constant effort that Jurgen Klopp tries to motivate out of his players. One of the differences that he noted between Klopp and Tuchel is the fact that Tuchel allows his players to shift it into another gear, to control the ball and control the pace of the game a little more than Klopp did, who wanted his team to move quickly and boldly and take advantage of transitions and uncertainty in other teams' defense and create that uncertainty with their pressing. So
that's interesting. That goes to the whole diagonal thing I'm talking about, because one thing I've noted watching Dortmund this season is the number of kind of, when they're in possession, the kind of orchestrated, very clearly practiced on the training ground diagonal runs, their wide players, or even a guy like Mkhitaryan who plays centrally, or Aubameyang who might start up top, the kind of diagonal runs they make, which they didn't make under Klopp because they were pressing high, and then they were winning the ball in transition, and then guys were just moving, right? It's different.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a great game tomorrow. I'm going to be in a car while it's happening, but I'm looking forward to catching it when I get home to Portland, as it's just as intriguing as any of these Champions League ties were, which is saying something because we've had some very interesting ties in Champions League. We're going to transition to talking about the Premier League here in a second, but Karthik, kind of going off script here for a second, I hope you indulge me. I want to jump down into the Championship very quickly, because since I was on the show, some things have, well, some things have changed, but some things have changed the same, stayed the same. So ever since we started updating people on what's going on in the Championship, there's been pretty much a steady top six in this league. Sheffield Wednesday has been lodged in sixth place for a while. Derby, despite their coaching change, has been fifth for a while. But there's been a shakeup in the top four. Now in fourth place, Hull, who a couple months ago looked like they were going to secure a place at the top of the league, they've fallen all the way down to fourth place. Brighton, who got off to a long undefeated run to start the year and then were wayward for a while, well, they're on another run, and they're now only 2 points behind second place Burnley, who are behind Middlesbrough. The reason I want to talk about this is because at the time when I had to leave the show, that was the time when we thought Aitor Karanka was going to leave the team. Well, things have been resolved since then, and now Middlesbrough have won 5 in a row. And with 82 points through 41 games, they're 4 points up on Brighton in third. And again, they look like they're in the driver's seat to win one of the 2 automatic promotion spots. What a crazy year in the Championship, Kartik. It's always crazy in the Championship. But what's going on with what's going on with Middlesbrough and Hull seems a little bit crazier than usual. Middlesbrough more so than Hull.
Yeah, so they're on 67 points when you left the show. And Karanka, they had just walked out on the team. They played a match against Charlton, who's going to get relegated and is in financial ruin because of their owner and their fan protests. They get beat. They get beat at the Valley 2-0. Shockingly, 2 days later, and I think that was your last show, was that Sunday, and we talked about that. Karanka comes back. And I thought, one, he wouldn't go back, and two, Middlesbrough wouldn't have him back. He comes back. They've won 5 on the trot since he came back. At the time, they were 8 points behind Burnley. Burnley has stagnated a bit since. There was a late draw. Well, Wolves got a late draw against them. Derby got a late draw against them. So now Burnley are only on 80 points. Brighton, as you mentioned, under Chris Hughton, once again on a big run, have almost caught Burnley. Borough are now back on top. They had an incredibly improbable winner midweek against Reading. Yeah. Google it. You'll find a YouTube clip. You won't believe the winning goal for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whereas 3 weeks ago they were losing to Rotherham and the bottom of the table, Charlton, as you said, now they seemingly can't lose, and they've made up the couple of matches they had in hand, closed that gap that you talked about, and now look like favorites to win one of the spots, not having to go into the playoff. The other end of the Championship table, a sad story. Bolton has confirmed relegation to the third tier. That might be the least of their problems. They are seemingly day by day facing potential winding up orders there. Just a really sad state for Bolton, one of the mainstays of the Premier League for most of the Premier League's existence. They look destined to go down, as do Charlton and Milton Keynes. Those 3 clubs have broken away from the pack at the bottom of the league. If the season ended today, Middlesbrough and Burnley would go up with Brighton, Hull, Derby, and Sheffield Wednesday into the playoff.
I want to point out something real quickly when you talk about those 3 teams going down. Rotherham looks like they're going to stay up for a third successive year. This will be the second straight year they stay up, which means a third successive year in the Championship, which is just unbelievable for a club of that size. In an area in Yorkshire where everybody, the Sheffield clubs, Leeds United, Huddersfield, Bradford City, everyone has fallen on hard times. They're really kind of the standout story in that part of the country, and good for them.
Hmm. Yeah, there are always remarkable stories like that in the Championship. It's a bigger division. They play more games. A lot of time for this kind of wackiness sounds trite, but that's kind of what it is. These wacky stories to develop because the games come so fast and furiously. You do get teams like Hull who get kind of sidetracked if they go too long in cup runs and they can't get their rhythm back.
Well, that's what happened to Hull.
Yeah.
I hate to say that they went too long in the FA Cup, for
yeah,
sure.
That it's whether actually making it as far as they did to face Arsenal or having to go to that replay, they haven't been the same since. And it's just weird. But it is what it is. We see it happen every year.
Which is why West Ham fans, I remember when Allardyce basically threw a cup match the year they were down in the Championship, and I had all these West Ham fans on Twitter and the few I talked to regularly saying, this is disgrace, you know, we're the great English club. Well, guess what? They got promoted. They're not complaining about that now, not making the fourth round of the FA Cup that season, and Allardyce throwing the cup, because Allardyce said at the time, on a Championship budget with a Championship team with 46 games, I can't have a big cup run. I'm not dishonoring the cup. I'm just being pragmatic and managing my resources. And West Ham was promoted. It could cost Hull, quite honestly, doing the opposite.
And we also see a manager like Nigel Clough at Sheffield United, who made his reputation on constantly taking United on cup runs. Eventually, it cost him his job because he could never win promotion.
Right.
Because the team always went too deep in the cups. It sounds paradoxical, But that's what happened to him, and now he's at Burton Albion. Let's shift our focus to the Premier League, Kartik, and since we were just talking about the Championship, let's talk about the bottom of the table in the First Division, where there's still a very active race, even though, because there hasn't been a shakeup amongst the three teams that are fighting for that last place in the league, it seems a little static right now. But Norwich, with 31 points through 33 rounds, isn't exactly in that safe of a position. I'm sure Canary fans don't need to be reminded of that, but the rest of the league fans probably do. Sunderland is 4 points behind them, but they have a match in hand, and as destitute as Newcastle seems, they're 6 points back and also have a game in hand with 6 matches to go. If either of those two teams from the Northeast survived, it wouldn't be a great escape. It's really kind of tight at the bottom of the table. Now the matches this weekend, two of those teams are facing off against each other. The first kickoff on Saturday has Sunderland facing Norwich at Carrow Road. Newcastle is going to be hosting Swansea in a game they really must win at St. James's Park in the midday kickoff on Saturday. But Kartik, let's focus on that matchup between Norwich and Sunderland. Norwich has actually been playing reasonably well lately. They have 7 points in their last 4 games. Sunderland, on the other hand, only has 3 points in that time. It's been quite a while since they won a match. In that respect, it's very difficult to imagine Sunderland winning this game. That being said, this is going to be a focus game for Sunderland. It really is almost a last stand. They can't afford to lose ground in this game. So you have to expect, if there's any effort left in the squad, we're going to see it on Saturday.
Yeah, they haven't played terribly. I mean, again, our pod was wiped out the other day, but we had Chris Hanna on, John, and he, of course, covers Sunderland and Newcastle, for those of you who remember him when he used to be on the show. And he agreed with my assessment that Sunderland hasn't been playing poorly, and maybe the results will start to come. He believes Newcastle is down already. Rafa, even a manager of his pedigree, that the squad is hopeless, and I tend to agree with that based on what we've seen since Rafa came in.
Not to interrupt, but I just can't remember a squad that just seems so soulless. And I think it's almost as if they seem to be carrying themselves as if they think they're too good for the situation they're in.
Yeah, right, because they have the 7th highest wage bill in the Premier League, by the way, this season, Newcastle.
Jesus.
So the usual top six, the big four plus Manchester City and Spurs, those are your six. It's in this order: Man United, Chelsea, Man City, Arsenal's fourth, fifth is Liverpool, sixth is Spurs. 7th highest wage bill is Newcastle. Which says a whole lot. So they're just checked out. So I think they're done. But what Chris and I kind of agreed on is that Sunderland, there are moments in each of these games the last month or month and a half where these games that have been draws or losses, where if a guy had finished a chance or a guy had made a tackle, they would have won the game. They would have gotten 3 points. So I don't know if there's anything more Allardyce can do. He's tactically set up the team well. Mm-hmm. They've got a creative player in Kaziri that they went out and got. Kone has been an upgrade. Kirchhoff has been an upgrade. So the signings have worked out. They just don't have that finisher, or there's just something missing. You know, there's some mistake that happens at the back. They get beat on a counter like they did by Vardy the other day. They need to get a draw at worst in this game. Obviously, if they lose, I think it's over. I think they'll probably get a draw. That's all they've been getting, right? And the draw still favors Norwich, but it gives an opening for Sunderland still to catch them. But Norwich has not played poorly either recently. And it seems like this game has draw written all over.
So the case for Norwich, as you note, they've been playing better recently. So looking purely at the table, you see they have 31 points through 33 rounds. That probably understates their quality a little bit at this point. I think Mbokani is playing better up front. He's still not necessarily producing goals, but he's a positive contribution at this point, particularly with him and Naismith, their relationship evolving a little bit. They've got Ruddy back in goal. I think the acquisition of Tim Klose in defense has helped. They're playing more defensively than they were at the beginning of the year, when I think they thought players like Nathan Redmond and Wes Houlihan could maybe outgun some teams. I don't think they're under that illusion anymore. As you alluded, a draw does serve them here, and you wonder, playing as well as they have recently, with Alex Neil seemingly figuring something out, if Sunderland's task is more difficult based on the fact that the team they're playing against might not necessarily be going for 3 points. Kartik, let's move to the other major race in the league, and that's the race for fourth place. Manchester City is starting to lock this one down. Whereas a couple of weeks ago, we thought Manchester United and West Ham were going to really push them. Now Manchester City has a 4-point lead on their Manchester rivals. West Ham is 5 points back. Manchester City has a difficult task, maybe a difficult task. I don't think we still have a good grip on how good Chelsea is, but Manchester City goes to Stamford Bridge in the last kickoff on Saturday. Chelsea coming off their first loss in league under Gus Hiddink this year. Manchester United will play the kickoff time before that, hosting Aston Villa. Aston Villa on track for the third worst record in Premier League history, behind only those terrible Derby and Sunderland teams. And then West Ham United will be at Leicester on Sunday. Obviously, they have the most difficult task. It's very difficult to see Leicester dropping points. And if they do, I'm not sure West Ham can expect 3 instead of 1 at the King Power Stadium. Talk to me about those games, Kartik. How do you think those 3 games are going to go down?
I think, first off, West Ham is very unfortunate. They've had 3 successive draws. All 3 games have had controversial calls, which will cost them. The penalty against Chelsea, the Coyote sending off against Crystal Palace, which was reversed by the league, rightfully so, was at worst a yellow card challenge. And then this disallowed goal against Arsenal, which cost them. They still rallied to get a 3-3 draw in that game, but that I think was something that cost them 3 points. So they are pretty much out of this race. I still think they'll give Leicester a game. They might get a draw in that game, but that's not going to be enough for them. As far as Manchester City at Chelsea get a lot of draws, right? So now, and it seems like City have spent a lot of their energy on Europe. That's the focus now. By the time that game kicks off, they'll know who they've drawn in the Champions League. So I'm going to say a draw there, and Manchester United should
there was a little too much hesitation there. They're at home against Aston Villa. I mean, you have to have a lot of skepticism about Manchester United, and not that it wouldn't be warranted.
But they lost at home to both Norwich and Sunderland, the 2 teams we talked about, Norwich and Sunderland, fighting relegation. They lost at home to both those teams this season. Oh, and they drew with Newcastle. So the other 3 teams that could get relegated along with Villa have all earned points at Old Trafford. So. I mean, maybe Villa gets a spirited draw. I could see it happening, as crazy as it sounds.
That really says something about how disappointing Manchester United has been this year, that despite the fact that they're in fifth place, despite the fact that they have a chance to make it back to Champions League, it's still not that difficult to make the case that they could drop points at home to one of the worst teams of the Premier League era. Wow, Manchester United just keeps finding more ways to remind us that this is not Alex Ferguson's Manchester United. Kartik, let's trickle down the table a little bit and talk about some of the games for the teams that are still competing for those last Europa League spots in the Premier League. 7th place right now is Southampton. They're 2 points behind West Ham. They're going to be at an Everton team that, despite playing with only 10 men for some of the match on Wednesday, got a 0-0 draw at Crystal Palace. Everton's drawn 13 times this year. They're in 12th place, haven't won in 5 at this point. Right behind Southampton is Liverpool. They're going to be at Bournemouth on Sunday. Bournemouth, a team that is slowly racing towards a top hat finish. They're in 11th place on 41 points. And then Stoke has the toughest challenge of all of the teams that are still on the fringe of Europe. They're going to be hosting Tottenham on Monday. Tell me what you foresee for Southampton, Liverpool, and Stoke.
Well, Spurs need to be playing really well right now, and they need to win that game to stay in the title race. They will know the Leicester result, obviously. Leicester's playing Sunday. So I have the sense that if Leicester get all 3 points against West Ham, which is one of the games remaining where Leicester could slip up, because then they've got Swansea at home and Everton at home, a trip to Old Trafford where they should get a point at least. And then the final game against Chelsea might not matter. I get the sense Spurs might be somewhat dispirited if they might draw this game with Stoke, who looked so awful against Liverpool at Anfield the other day, and you would expect a bounce back performance. So I'm gonna hedge a little bit and say it depends on the Leicester result. If Leicester get a full 3 points against West Ham, I think Spurs will be dispirited. They'll drop points and the title race will be over. As far as Southampton and Everton, they draw a lot, as you said. They concede a lot of goals. Southampton don't concede many goals. But they were beat 3-0 in the reverse fixture earlier in the season, which was one of the wake-up calls about how bad Southampton were early in the season. Southampton have obviously recovered from that slow start.
Yeah, that seems like so long ago.
that was so. But remember, there was a point we were concerned about them getting sucked into a relegation fight.
Yeah.
They started so poorly, and Pella wasn't scoring, and Shane Long was hurt, and Wanyama was getting suspended a lot, and Mane wasn't playing well. Mane's still not scoring goals, but when he plays, he's playing better.
Well, the turning point of the year seems to be when Fraser Forster came back. I don't know if that's just coincidental or not, but it's...
No, I don't think it's coincidental. I think that has a lot to do with it. Goalkeepers are important. I know we don't like to... We give them less attention on this show and on other shows than other places, but even the organization of their defense, it's not just the saves he makes, but you saw that guys like Font started to play much better once Forster was back. The confidence of knowing you've got a great keeper behind you, and also just the way he organizes the defense. Yeah, so I think Southampton get at least a point here. Maybe they get all three. Look, again, they started the season so poorly. It's interesting. If you take the season from a certain point, I think they're probably pushing for the top four. But they started again so poorly. And then the other game was Liverpool. Liverpool should get something down in Bournemouth. Bournemouth have played very well of late, obviously, but other than that game against Manchester City last week. Liverpool, I don't know, Richard, this might be me going out on a limb. I think Spurs are certainly your title favorites going into next season, but boy, Klopp has got them playing well now, and he gets a Gundogan and maybe he gets a Marco Reus. There are rumors of the Dortmund players going there. They might be a title favorite themselves.
I'm looking forward to next year. God.
Yeah. The guys he's got now are playing well for him. So I think Liverpool might run the table in the league. And they're not going to get the fourth. It's happened a little late. But right now, and especially the way they went to Dortmund, I don't know that there's another team in the Premier League, including Leicester and Spurs, the top two teams in the league, that could have gone and gotten that result. I just think Liverpool, they had a lot of bumps, but they turned that corner. Well, and they're playing the way their manager wants them to now, and they're pretty much fit.
Let's think about next year for a little bit. We've talked probably since December or January about how we all feel Spurs are the favorite going into next season. Great. Leicester now has Champions League money, and they're going to have a lot more commercial money. As we're seeing, they're going to be touring the United States. They're going to have a lot more money from Asia because of their connections there. They really have the potential, because of the unique situation they're in, to solidify their place right now. Manchester City is obviously getting Pep Guardiola, who, no matter what you think about how much of an upgrade he is on Manuel Pellegrini, he's never finished lower than second place in a league before. So that's reason to expect that they'll compete. And then I agree with you on Liverpool. And even on the next level, Arsenal can still be title contenders next year. Manchester United is going to spend a lot of money. Chelsea is going to regroup. Can we just fast forward to next year at this point? Because I think Leicester's going to win this title. I'm ready for next season to start, because as wide open as this year has been, next year looks even more wide open. I'm really excited about it.
Chelsea's going to be better under Conte. They're going to retool. Pep is going to retool City to a certain extent. I don't know if they'll be better or about the same, but they won't be worse. Man United should be better. Who else? Liverpool's definitely going to be better. Arsenal? I don't know. This could be the year they fall out of the top four, honestly. Unless he makes some changes, unless this has woken him up and he's just not saying it now, and you start to see the moves that need to be made. They really need another ball winner in midfield, and they have to get their hands on somebody who's going to really spread the play from wide areas. You know, not a guy like Walcott who's barely serviceable at times, or Ox, who's more of a central midfield player you push out wide. Ramsey, central midfielder you push out wide. They really need an out and out wide player, a guy like Amaris, quite honestly. I mean, maybe that's the guy. I don't know. My sense is that Conte and Mahrez are sold. They're not sold within the Premier League. I think they're going to like a Bayern or a Real Madrid. I don't think those guys, because Leicester has no need to sell those guys within the league, and if they are going to sell them, and they're going to be forced by the agents or by the players themselves to be sold, I think they'll just ship them out. Or maybe PSG for Conte, because he's French. Mahrez is French too, even though he plays for Algeria. Maybe
I can see something like
go to PSG.
I can see something where Juventus finally sells Pogba and they take half that money and buy Conte. I can see something like that happening.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But I definitely don't see Leicester selling to Arsenal. Even if a player tried to force that move, Leicester, there's just not enough money to make it so Leicester would take that deal over a comparable deal they would have from a team on the continent. The thing that's scary about Arsenal.
Yeah, because somebody asked me, this week, don't you think Pep will go out and get Mahrez? That would be the guy that would fit like the Robin description, the Robin type player he liked on the wing.
Right.
So there's no, I said to this person, there's no reason for Leicester to sell him within the league. I don't think he's going to sell him to Man City.
Yeah, it's
sure.
More,
I'm sure Pep would love the guy, but that's not going to happen.
It's more likely he would actually get Robin than get Mahrez.
I agree with that.
You know, the scary thing for Arsenal is, say Wenger does identify a player that he wants, it would have to also be a player that none of those other teams that you and I mentioned want. Because when was the last time Arsenal won a bidding war for a player that that Chelsea or United wanted also, or City wanted also? When was the last time Manchester United won?
Well, we know several cases of we know they were in a position where they could have triggered the release clause on Juan Mata, chose not, and then Chelsea got him a couple of weeks later. I mean, there are several examples of that sort of thing happening with Arsenal. So, yeah. We've seen them linked with other players who then ended up at Chelsea or Man City. I don't know, unless, they just have to go for it now. Look, it's one thing to not win the league, which they're not going to win the league once again for the 11th straight year. It's another thing if you're a gooner to finish behind Spurs, which they're almost certainly going to do at this point. And that might really be the thing that shakes everything up. Not that they finish third again. They finish third or fourth every year for the last decade, but finishing behind Tottenham. Because that's the one thing they always had, right? They would get these miraculous fourth place finishes where Spurs would finish fifth on the last day and they'd be celebrating like they'd won a cup or they'd won the league. And they would always, the Arsenal fans' defense would always be ridicule of Tottenham. Well, clearly they don't have that anymore. And Tottenham isn't, there was an Arsenal fan who told me recently, well, Tottenham, you know, will have to sell everyone. No, they don't have to sell anyone anymore.
No.
They used to have to sell guys. I don't think Kane is going anywhere. I don't think Eriksen's going anywhere. I don't think, Dele Alli's going anywhere. I think the core of that team is going to be together for a few more years. Although Varela, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So, maybe Lloris goes to, whatever bigger club needs a keeper, PSG maybe. But other than that, I don't think they're going to lose anyone. And that means they'll probably be better than Arsenal for the foreseeable future, unless Arsenal makes the kind of big moves that Wenger has been reluctant to make. With the exception, of course, of the Alexis Sanchez move. That was a big move.
The Ozil one, too. Yeah.
Right. The Ozil one, though, was, I think, a last-minute thing triggered by Madrid's need to sell people to get Bale.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And also, people who know Arsenal have said that Arsene Wenger had to be talked into taking Ozil at that price, too. He didn't want to spend that much for Ozil. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I think going back to Tottenham, for people that maybe have only been listening to this show for the last couple of months, we've talked about the unique situation with Tottenham before, and this is part of the reason we're so confident Tottenham are going to be favorites next year going to the Premier League, is that the unique thing about their success is they aren't doing it with people that the big buyers in Europe are going to poach off of them. The talent that they have, you go player for player, and with the exception of Christian Eriksen, there probably isn't a player that the big spenders, the Barcelonas, Real Madrids, Bayerns, PSGs, except for Eriksen and potentially Lloris, there aren't players that those teams would necessarily use. So there isn't the threat of losing those guys because Tottenham doesn't have to sell within the league. They have no incentive to do that. And at this point, the players don't have much incentive to make that kind of move either. So that's part of the reason why we're so confident that Tottenham's going to go into next year as the favorite. Well, everybody, we're going to be back this weekend. To be honest with you, we're not exactly sure when. Kartik alluded to the fact that we didn't have a show on Sunday. With such a big game on Monday, we might be a day late getting the podcast out. I know Stoke versus Spurs doesn't seem like a big game, but it does affect the championship race, it does affect the race for Europa, and plus it gives us another day to digest the results. Either way, if you don't see the podcast in the feed on Monday morning, check back later on Monday. I'm going to be with you. Kartik potentially is going to be with you. We might have Gabe Smith with us also. Until then, for everybody at the World Soccer Talk family, I'm Richard Farley. Kartik?
Enjoy your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737. Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast. And Nipun is NipunChopra7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email. Richard@worldsoccertalk.com. Okay, Kartik, I'm still recording. I want to talk about Major League Soccer stuff, and I'm going to tack it on to the end of the show Easter egg for people that stay past the credits. And we can tell people to keep listening if we want them to hear this stuff, because you and I wanted to talk about De Jong and Nagby, but there really wasn't a natural place within the show to fit it in. And plus, you and I know that a lot of people who exclusively watch the Premier League barely can tolerate us talking about Germany and Spain. They are not going to tolerate us talking about Major League Soccer.
Yeah.
And who knows? We might actually talk about the women's national team here too, since there's controversy around them all the time. But let's talk about De Jong and Darlington Nagby. I would normally describe what happened on Sunday, but if you stuck around for this part of the show, you know what controversy is going around Major League Soccer right now. And the reason we're talking about this now is we're a couple of hours from the first quotes from Bruce Arena hitting the public, where Bruce Arena basically called the reaction to Sunday's incident hysteria, and he blamed the coverage for hyping up what was, to him, a bad tackle. He conceded that it should have possibly been a red card, but he also theorized that Darlington Nagby wasn't actually hurt on the play and that he had hurt his ankle earlier in the day and that De Jong's challenge didn't do any harm to him. I find that just, that last part just gobsmacking.
That's kind of ridiculous.
It's something Alex Ferguson would do to distract the press from an issue. It's like that level.
Which is what Arena is doing, although Arena is right about this hysteria, Richard. I mean, I tweeted, you can go back on my Twitter timeline. Those of you who are listening this far on the show are probably fans of the domestic game in the U.S., and so you probably do follow me on Twitter. I said right after, this is a borderline red. Shouldn't he have been sent off about 11:28 or so p.m. Eastern time, 8:30 p.m. on the West Coast? Had a back and forth with some people saying, yeah, this was a red. This is a terrible challenge. I hope they reverse it. I hope they make it a red. I hope they suspend him for a game or two. Go to bed, because it's later in my time on the East Coast. I wake up in the morning, and it's like, basically, De Jong has committed murder, and he should be deported, and maybe we should hang him, and all this sort of stuff, this hysteria that somehow got worked up overnight, Sunday night into Monday morning, on both the East and West Coast. And Richard, I mean, by that time, I didn't flip my position. I still said, hey, I think he should be suspended. This should be a red card with a mistake, the call. It's a shame that Nagby is a player that, for U.S. Soccer, for an American player and for MLS, is very rare, that he's good in tight spaces. He's good on the ball, although he took a bit of a heavy touch, it should be noted, that led to this. But I mean, it seemed like I had flipped my position when I had, and I had just said, okay, it was a bad tackle. It should be a red card. He should be suspended. Then the next day it was, oh, he should be thrown out of the league, and he's a thug, and he's a this. And, we know Nigel De Jong's history, and those of you who are Premier League fans know his history from Manchester City, when he broke Hakan Ben Arfa's leg, when he was playing for the Dutch national team and he broke Stuart Holden's leg, and the World Cup, and the challenge that Howard Webb subsequently admitted he should have been sent off for, and just kind of the physical play he brought, that edge to Manchester City and then to Milan when he went to Serie A after. But no, he's not a rapist. He's not a murderer. He shouldn't be drawn and quartered. It was a bad tackle. He should be suspended for two or three games, and that'll be that.
So I was actually at StubHub Center. That's what we'll always call it. Yeah, there's modern soccer for you, right? You have to relearn the names of stadiums every two or three years. So I was at StubHub Center on Sunday, and probably the press box is the worst place to form opinions on these things, because you're watching from elevated angles. You only get to see limited replays. And it wasn't until after the game, when the photos started coming through, that we really got to see the real solid contact that De Jong made with Nagby's ankle. And at that point, I kind of thought when I saw it in real time that it was a borderline red. And eventually I went to the point where I said, you know, this is worthy of a 3 or 4 match suspension. At some point, you have to be responsible for your actions. And when you put somebody in that danger, I think you need that kind of suspension. So I think I'm a little bit to the more strident of opinions than you, but just a little bit, because I'm definitely not at the point where I think this is a Zakawani or Morales level incident. And I think people are trying to make it into that mostly because of De Jong's reputation, which I'm not actually sure how much that should factor into any kind of assessment of punishment here. But secondly, because for some reason, Darlington Nagby has become a favorite son of the U.S. men's national team fan base, and they seem to be taking this personally.
Yeah, the U.S. soccer fan is taking this very personally because, again, Nagby is a national team player. He's become the great hope of the national team for so many people because he is a guy you can play outside, inside. He can play in center midfield, as we saw in the playoff run last year, when Caleb Porter moved him to more or less the number 10 role after having been out wide for so many years. He is probably the best American dribbling in tight space since Claudio Reyna, John O'Brien. I mean, it's been a long time since the U.S. has had a player of that skill on the ball in tight spaces. So there's a lot of hype around him. There's a lot of desire to protect. And then you bring in the Nigel De Jong factor. Then you bring in the LA Galaxy, who are a hated team, and Bruce Arena's a hated coach, and the fact that Bruce Arena, for those of you who don't realize this, Bruce Arena has been able to somehow get Ashley Cole and Nigel De Jong to sign contracts with the Galaxy at below designated player level. They're making what Americans make in the league, you know, maybe slightly more than your good American player, about what your good American player makes, not your Dempsey or Altidore, a lot less than they make, or Michael Bradley, but what your even less than your Graham Zusis and your Matt Beislers make. So, yeah. Because there is a culture now around the Galaxy, they're a recognized club. David Beckham put them on the global map. Landon Donovan kept them there. Robbie Keane elevated it. You know, Steven Gerrard elevated. Now they're seen as a big club globally. So where Ashley Cole will take a pay cut to play for them, he wouldn't take a pay cut to play for anyone else in MLS. He probably wouldn't consider playing for anyone else in MLS. So there's a resentment of the Galaxy. And I think that that's fueled it, all of this, and the U.S. national team fanboy, for lack of a better term. I know it's a condescending term, but that aspect. And let me point out one other thing. You mentioned press boxes. The previous week, you and I did a pod, another show of yours, about the Portland-Orlando game. Breck Shea had committed a heinous challenge in that game where he was not sent off. Breck Shea plays for Orlando. I was at the game. I covered the game. I did a pod with you the next night. Didn't mention the challenge. I had remembered it, and I just remembered it as being this, you know, hard challenge in the 15th minute. I hadn't seen a replay. MLS then retroactively made it a red card. I watched the replay. I'm like, oh, my goodness. How could I not have noticed that in the press box? And then on the replay screen in the press box, that was a straight red any day of the week. So basically, I think a lot of times, Richard, you and I have found in the last 2 weeks, when you're in press boxes and you're covering a game and it's bang, bang, and then there's a replay, but you're also like writing your match story or tweeting something about the match at the same time. We don't do as well as the people who are watching at home on television do in picking up on some of these things, quite frankly, which might be why some of our analysis of the Premier League here in the United States, watching off of monitors, is better than some of the guys at the games. Kyle Martino does such a good job in the NBC studio. He does a better job. He and Robbie Earle and Robbie Musto do a better job than their counterparts in the UK on British television, quite frankly, who are at stadium sites. So there's something to be said for that.
We're still left in a situation where, because MLS is a universe where they've accepted that retroactive review punishment is something that helps the game, and that's something I believe too, we're left in a universe where people have time to let their biases seep in. And for me, and I'm supposed to write about this tonight, I'm kind of talking about this out loud. Maybe you'll have a point that I can incorporate into my column. For me, it becomes philosophically dubious how to untangle our biases from judgment when we don't really have control over it. A lot of these biases are subconscious. Are for a lot of people, when they react to Nagby getting hurt by De Jong, there's this confluence of unconscious factors that fuel their ire. Is it really reasonable to expect that the league and the disciplinary committee are immune to that? Or or they're immune to the biases that go with trying to make a credible decision in the face of that ire.
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of questions this year about PRO, the officials here in the United States, run by Peter Walton, former Premier League official, a good one too, a good official, and he's doing the best he can with PRO. But there have been a rash of red cards. There were 12 straight reds in the first 34 MLS games of the season. There were 3 straight reds in the first 4 NASL games of the season. Similar kind of numbers in USL as well. I don't have the exact numbers there. So this rash of red cards, and then there was this furor about all the red cards. So then you have officials trying consciously not send guys off. And then the 2 weeks since then in MLS, we've had these two incidents, the Breck Shea incident in the Portland-Orlando game, which should have been a straight red very early in the game, would have changed the complexion of the game. And then, of course, this situation in this game with Beyond, albeit that was late in the game, probably wouldn't have changed the result. Both situations for Portland, the reigning champions, have felt hard done. So when you start to scrutinize officials and say that they're over-regulating the game, then you have this natural pullback from officials, and then the disciplinary committee has to get involved and reverse those calls from officials. So it's a tough balancing act we have here. And we have a situation where we publish the names of every referee that are going to call game, that are going to take control of games, and their assistant referees and the fourth official early in the week. The NASL, the second division, which I used to work for, tried to pull out of that this week and got so much backlash that they reinstated it. So for 1 week, the NASL official assignments weren't posted publicly until the day before the game. Now they're going to revert to posting them on Tuesdays for games on Saturdays and Sundays. There's so much. And, you know, Richard, this is kind of a symptom of maybe the British game. You and I used to talk years ago about how in England they would publish the names of referees in papers, and referees had become stars, and everybody knew the referee staff and who was going to take control of which game. That's now happened in the United States. And the referees themselves are stars. I mean, we talk about Mark Geiger and Ted Uncle and Shire Marufo all the time. I mean, so many of my conversations with my friends, not just Twitter people or people that I interact with specifically on certain subjects in the game, but my friends around the game end up inevitably coming to these referees. And it's not just, oh, the referee was terrible, he made this mistake. It was always, we know the name of the referee, and we know the history of the referee. And it wasn't like that in the United States 5 years ago. So I think it's all part and parcel of something bigger going on, and I'm not sure if it's healthy or unhealthy. It's just evolution, I guess.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to bring up, and my editor didn't like this angle, but I think it's one that I struggle with all the time, is, you know, whenever things like this happen, you'll hear people say, you know, people know this is a contact sport, they know they can get hurt, et cetera, et cetera. I just can't think of any place in life besides certain sports, not even all sports, certain sports, where you're allowed to be so careless with people's safety. Even taking DeJong's tackle this week, and I think you and I agree that it wasn't malicious. There was no intent to injure behind it. For me, it was just an attempt to stop a counterattack, a cynical one at that.
Yeah, he didn't come in with reckless and overwhelming force. That's the reason why this is not, shouldn't be a 10 or 15 game suspension like all these people are wanting. It was a professional foul that was hard, that was attempted to break up a counter late in the game where the Galaxy were trying to hold on to a point. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but he still came over the ball, and I know the challenge he's trying to make.
Yeah, his studs were still out.
Right.
He was trying
to put his foot down right in front of Nagby, so Nagby would be forced to run into his body, run into his shoulder and hip. And unfortunately, he misplaced his foot, and he almost broke Darlington Nagby's ankle. I can't think of any kind of place in society other than soccer, NFL football, some other sports, where you're allowed to be so casual about another person's safety. And I mean, maybe people are going to look at this as being too soft and, you know, wanting to put all our children in plastic bubbles so they don't touch any germs or anything, but I just don't know that soccer needs to be a game where we have to be that casual about things. We already have things that are very hard to legislate. Like when two people go up for an aerial challenge, it's very difficult to legislate that. I don't know why we can't be very strict about, don't slide into somebody, don't foul somebody in this situation, because You're stopping a play that's still 45 yards from goal. I mean, can't we just let this go? And if you don't think you can let it go, just know that the league does not in any way condone you taking a 1% risk with another player's health simply because you want to stop a counterattack. I don't know if that's that bad of a world to live in if we are that strict about being respectful of people's health.
Right, of course, then you'll have all these people, particularly in England, who say, well, you know, when I played, that wasn't even a foul. You get that time and time again when you watch these Premier League games. And now it's a red card. And so that's the balancing act, right? But I think we're further ahead in the United States in looking at player health and player welfare as a consideration and possible head injuries. So I have no problem with over-legislating if a guy says safety is in danger. We saw several years ago, MLS gave a 10-game suspension for a leg break. Brian Mullen, who was not a dirty player historically, I think Mullen has probably won as many MLS Cups as anyone. In some cases, he was on the right place at the right time. But he was, at least on those San Jose Houston teams, a guy that contributed mightily to their success. And his career kind of has been remembered now for this leg break on Steve Zaccheroni, who was a promising, exciting attacking player for Seattle at the time. So, he got the book thrown at him, and it's the kind of suspension you wouldn't see in another country, right? You wouldn't see that in the Premier League. It'd be a 3-game suspension. That's it. Mario Balotelli broke Bakary Sagna's leg. He got a 3-game suspension. I mean, there are several. De Jong broke Hazen Ben Arfa's leg. He got a 3-game suspension. I'm just giving Man City examples because those are the ones I remember, but there's several examples like that in the Premier League. And so we've taken it seriously in the United States, but I guess there is another side of it, which is the competitiveness of the sport. I don't think the Young challenge rises that level. Yes, he almost did seriously injure Nagy, but I don't think that was his intent. He didn't go in with a lot of force. He was a clumsy in the process of trying to break up a quick counterattack that was coming late in the game where they were trying to hold on to a point.
All right, Kartik. Well, I will talk to you at some point this weekend. For people who have listened to this Easter egg, there's a potential that I will record with Kartik on Saturday and talk to him about Saturday's Premier League games because he's going to be in Orlando covering MLS. I'm actually going to be in Portland covering MLS too, although because of the time difference, I will be able to potentially record with Gabe this show, or there's a possibility that the three of us, or maybe the two, you and I, will record on Monday and use the Monday game as an excuse to record a day later. But I'll talk to you then, Kartik. Nice talking to you, man.
Thank you, Richard. All right.